Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast spotlighting some of the area's most interesting and accomplished women. Amy Ward will make you a vodka soda. Just be sure to tell her how you're doing first. Hospitality is key for Amy, a bartender who worked at Baltimore's Bad Decisions and Wit and Wisdom before taking over the Agio Bar program. Now Amy is the lead bartender at Our Bar, which is inside Remington's new food hall, Our House. Amy has had stints in athletics and academia, and she talked about the transition over to full-time bartending and what she has had to learn about branding herself. We also talked about field hockey, flamingos, and keeping Baltimore weird. Here's our conversation. Where are you from originally?
I am from Edgewater, Maryland, so in Anne Arundel County. Farm country? No longer farm country, but it was when I grew up there.
And you lived there your whole life?
Yeah, I moved to Baltimore probably 8 years ago, I think. And then I was in Edgewater until I was 18 and then moved out as soon as I could. I was always very much want to live on my own, want to be independent, you know, how to get out and do that kind of thing.
Why were you eager to get out of Edgewater?
I mean, I always enjoyed, it was kind of farm country, but also water country. It's essentially the Essex or Dundalk of South County, Maryland. I loved it. I loved growing up on the water, but I've always been a very independent individual. I wanted to live on my own. I wanted to, you know, prove that I could make it work and get a job and do all that kind of stuff. So I did as soon as I could. I dropped out of Edgewater and got out of there as soon as I could. And my poor parents, my brother and I both moved out within 2 weeks of one another, so it kind of broke their heart.
Like instant empty nesters.
Yeah, it wasn't intentional. It just my brother's 2 years older than me, and our timing kind of worked out as such that he was ready to go, and as soon as I was 18, I was like, I'm ready to go. Gotta get out.
So were you doing a lot of farm and water stuff growing up there? What was the childhood like in Edgewater?
For sure, more water stuff. I mean, the farm, like, in Anne Arundel County, there's definitely lots of farms and there's vineyards and there's all kinds of stuff, but I grew up closer to the water. I call it farm country because people just don't really know the area. It's Edgewater. It was probably on the edge of the water, and that would be simple just to say that. I just always go towards cow country. Crabbed, boated, did all that stuff. My brother and I spent most of our summers out on the pier at the water that was closest to our community. Crabbed, brought crabs that were not like the legal size home to our parents to try to steam and eat for dinner, and thought we were really cool about it. And my brother still lives down there. My dad and my brother are still down there, and my brother has a boat and is out on the water all the time, so he's continued that tradition. I just try to tag along whenever I can.
Do you make it back there often?
Yeah, I mean, I want to see my brother and my dad as much as I possibly can. My brother also has three kids, so I have a niece and two nephews that I want to see. I try to make it work as best as possible. They're both very busy. You know, my brother's busy with his family. My dad's very busy with his job. He works in D.C., and I'm clearly swamped. So try to make it back as much as I possibly can. My dad and I struggle to find time to have dinner together just to catch up, but we try to do as much as we can.
So where did you head when you were 18?
Not much better. Closer to the Bay Bridge, Cape St. Clair. And then Glen Burnie, and then did a brief stint of being married and moved to Columbia, where White Picket Fences land was, and not my style, and then eventually got into Baltimore finally.
So what were you doing in all of those places? Were you bartending?
No. So my entire background is actually in education and physical wellness. So I ended up I went to Maryland and did a kinesiology program for my undergrad, and did the same thing for a master's, but kind of moved towards like the physical cultural side of the body.
What does that mean?
Really nerdy way of saying that I wrote a lot of papers. So my degree, I have a bachelor's in kinesiology, and then I have a master of art in kinesiology. Kinesiology is exercise physiology, essentially, and I had the more proper biological sense of it in my undergrad, but then I was very outspoken, always have been, and so they kind of primed me to be into their physical cultural studies program, where you got to really examine the politics of the body in sport. And I was originally going to do something related, my master's was going to be related to field hockey and how it was a female sport in the United States, but was a male sport anywhere else. And I ended up doing my entire master's thesis on tattooing, the politics of the tattooed body and how reality television was like destroying everything about the tattooing process, and like the really rich and like divided and crazy story of how Western tattooing came to be.
Do you have a lot of tattoos?
I do. Yeah.
When did you start getting those?
18.
Everything was at 18.
18th birthday. Got pierced, got tattooed, and it all went downhill from there. But I was the last person in my family to get tattooed, so I guess that was kind of the funniest part of it. I'm the one that kept going with the tradition, but I think my mom was first, my dad was second, my brother got a little musical note on his back shoulder, and then I started off with the very classic butterflies, as a young 18-year-old lady would do, and now it's, spiraled in out of control into lots and lots of flamingos and other kinds of crazy animals on my body.
Are the flamingos a Baltimore reference?
To a degree, yes. I love flamingos. Everybody, any of my friends know that I love flamingos, and they, trinkets or photos or whatever they find, they send it to me, and I love it. I'm actually one of the people that loves flamingos. I love the tackiness and awkwardness of a flamingo. I feel like I am, the flamingo is my spirit animal. I am as like strong and bold as I try to be at all times. I'm also super awkward and either fidgety or I trip on flat surfaces or, throw a shaker behind my head accidentally sometimes. I try to be coordinated and I am not. It's 50-50. So the flamingo is very much near and dear to my heart.
And why is field hockey near and dear to your heart? Did you play?
Yeah. In high school, I played field hockey. I actually got cut from the soccer team my freshman year. And I was like, all right, I guess I'll go try to play field hockey, because field hockey was the sport that nobody liked or cared about. And they were struggling to have people on there. And as a freshman, I walked on and made it onto the varsity team, like immediately, because I volunteered to be a goalie, because I'm one of those crazy people that enjoys getting, 70 mile an hour shots at my body, with the appropriate equipment. So I started the long road of being a field hockey goalie, and I loved it. And by the time I graduated my program at South River High School, they ended up being really good. We kind of like fostered in that field hockey family type thing. And then they went really above and beyond after, I think they won states like after I graduated. And then I didn't like take the traditional route into college. I did community college and worked for a while just because I wanted to be on my own. I moved out. I never lived in a dorm or anything like that. So I played for an adult league in Baltimore Field Hockey Association. And eventually when I ended up going to Maryland, my clock had expired for your eligibility to play in college. So I got asked by Georgetown University to be their goalie coach. So I went to Maryland and coached at Georgetown all in the same time, which was kind of weird. And then continued playing field hockey up until about 9 or 10 years ago, when I found roller derby, which I found while doing my master's thesis on tattooing, because I found a Tattoo Times magazine where there was a woman on the cover that had junkyard dolls scrawled across her chest. And reading that particular article, I found out there was roller derby in Baltimore. I had to go and check it out. I went and I saw it, and I met that woman whose name was Coach Ballbricker. And she could not give a care less about me. She was outside on her skate smoking a cigarette. And I was like, oh my God, you're a lady from the cover. She's like, yeah. What's up? Like, couldn't give a crap less while I was fangirling over her. And yeah, I watched it. I fell in love with it and then tried out for a roller derby. And then field hockey kind of fell to the wayside because I found another sport where women were fully engaged. You're practicing 3 to 5 times a week, whereas field hockey was like you get together for a tournament once every other month or so. And, completely fell head over heels in love with it and never really picked back up for field hockey, though my field hockey family is still very much a part of my life. They came to our house a couple weeks ago, came to my job a couple weeks ago to have like a reunion before they go to Argentina for some big tournament. And it's like the people I've known for, 15 years that I met, like as I became an adult and moved out and started playing club hockey. And their kids are graduating college. When I first met them, they had, they were on blankets playing while we're doing our tournaments and stuff like that. So yeah, field hockey, roller derby for about 8 or 9 years.
When you were doing roller derby, you were once on Female Trouble, right?
I was, yeah. I was a captain of Female Trouble.
One of the few people who I assume understands the reference of the name of this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't always go over easily.
Amazing. Nice girls don't wear cha-cha heels.
That's right.
I love it.
So are you still doing roller derby?
Right now, I'm still on the boards and everything like that. I am not playing, but next month I'm going to go back and try to get into their rec league that they recently developed. Another one of the really heavily involved women. Her name's Throttle Her. Tanya is her real name. She has worked really hard to develop a rec program for retired skaters, people that can't make the full commitment to the attendance because it's pretty in-depth attendance requirements that you have to make to be on the league. So I'm going to try to do that starting next month. And for the last year, I have not been involved just because the bar world is very demanding and I could not make time for the level of attendance. Again, like it's a lot of physical demand on your body So they want you to be at practice more regularly so you can get the safety standards, practice, repetition, so you don't hurt yourself or others. I just couldn't commit to that while trying to run the program.
So you were moving all around, working in kinesiology, living the white picket fence lifestyle for a little bit. Yeah. What was the transition to bartending?
I actually had started dating somebody that owned a bar. And I guess as a way to be able to, I thought it was a way for us to spend time together. I later found out it was because he didn't want me complaining about him not charging me for my drinks anymore. I was like, I need a tab. You got to charge me for my drink. So he let me work it off instead. I guess that's what he intended on. So I started bartending at night in conjunction with my other job, my like full-time 9-to-5 job. And just after about 5 or 6 years, I loved it more than anything else I was doing. So,
and was that in Baltimore?
Mm-hmm. Yep, it was in Baltimore. And I was, so it was a combination of, I had been an academic advisor. So teaching physical education always was a part. I was a PE teacher as soon as I got out of, as soon as I finished my undergrad, and then went back to my master's, and then ended up becoming an academic advisor and working with students, college athletes and stuff like that at Maryland. And then found my way into Johns Hopkins, still bartending along the side. And just after a while, I fell in love with that more. It was still education. I still got to teach people about spirits or cocktails. And it became far more fulfilling than dealing with perhaps stuffy individuals that did not think I really belonged in their desk life setting.
Before you started working at bars, were you into cocktails?
I was a beer gal. I loved beer. I loved really heavy beers. I still love beer, but not nearly as much as I love whiskey and Amaro and spirits and cocktails. And I was a beer snob for sure. And then by starting that job bartending, I became more well-versed in spirits and realized how cool they were and what ones, you know, wouldn't make you have a hangover in the morning, because that was probably the reason why I didn't enjoy spirits, is because I spent too many nights at Baja Beach Club and Power Plant drinking terrible things and living to regret it the next day.
Yeah, that'll ruin you.
Yeah, a little bit.
So did you take to bartending easily?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I'm loud, I'm obnoxious, and I like talking to people. So it gave me the platform to do that and not really have to hold back anything. Whereas when you're in a desk environment, you need to keep an appropriate tone, conduct yourself a certain way for the environment that you're working in. So I got to be more of myself, I guess. And that was far more comfortable than any other 9-to-5 job I'd had.
How did you go from being a beginning bartender to eventually like running bar programs and getting to the level that you're at now?
About 3 years ago, I decided that I really wanted to focus more on bartending. I was going to try to make the transition out of my 9-to-5 job and find a full-time bartending gig. And that kind of happened while one of my peers, who now works with me at my bar, saw me shaking a Manhattan and wanted to know what the hell I was doing. And I'm like, I don't know. By that time, like, the person who had been teaching me how to make cocktails really just was running the business and not really teaching anymore. So it became on me to like pick up the books and try to learn everything I possibly could about classic cocktails, what made a balanced cocktail, why you shake, why you stir, why any of that is relevant to the actual art of cocktails. And fell in love with it more than I possibly could have thought, like, because I already really enjoyed bartending. It was my nighttime, part-time thing that really just gave me a platform to let loose. But then I actually really loved it because there was such a really cool art and science to it. So just started, you know, really educating myself and then trying to go to New York and see what they were doing in New York, go to DC, see what they were doing in DC, and, you know, finally just said, all right, this is it. I'm done with the 9-to-5. And when I was last at Hopkins before I transitioned over into the bar world, I briefly went to Wit and Wisdom for about 3 months and then eventually took over the Agio program. But when I told them I told the Hopkins team that I was leaving and going to do bartending, they're like, oh, that makes so much sense. That's perfect. That's perfect for you. And one of the doctors I worked with, who was amazing, Dr. Cindy Rand, she came to visit me the other day at my work and brought me bitters that her husband had been making. And she promised me 2 years ago she was going to bring them to me. And she finally did, and they were great.
And your Instagram handle is Bitters Queen,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, yes.
So you love the bitters.
I love bitters. I have a super bitter palate, I guess. I like, sweet is too much for me. Everything tastes sweet to me, so I'm very much a bitters fanatic. So a couple years ago, I just started playing with bitters a lot more and sneaking them into my drinks so people wouldn't be scared of it. and it kind of worked out really well. Like, I would do that and be like, oh, well, you've got this thing in there, and it's all bitters, and you wouldn't know that because it tastes delicious. And so it got people over the initial hump of bitters, because our bodies are kind of trained to take bitters in as an alarming thing for the body. Like, they think it's a unhealthy, poisonous, I guess, sorry, trying to find my words. Bitters are associated with being poison to the body, so people's natural reaction to them is generally such as, like, making the gross face or really not liking it. So I found that when you start mixing them into popular drinks that people already know about, then that gets them over that hump, and then they can start to appreciate the more finite pieces of the bitters puzzle for each individual one.
What do you like about the educational aspect of, like, showing people bitters or things that they might not normally choose?
I'm a huge nerd, so educating is just kind of cool anyways. It's not like a show-off thing, but, like, trying to teach people this very rich history about how, if you're just taking bitters or Amaro into consideration, like, most of Amaro, which is bitters in Italian, that started from poor farmers in Italy. Like, they got, when they were working on the vineyards, they would give the workers the scraps, the pumice, and they would turn that into grappa. So grappa was really the poor man's drink, even though it's elegant and beautiful when it's done well. And then they did one step further and took that grappa and then started steeping it with the botanicals from whatever the terroir, whatever area, if you're Piedmont or Puglia or something like that, like, whatever is native to that land, they'd start taking those roots and flowers and everything they could possibly find and steeping it with that. And they'd come up with this really incredible tasting spirit that would later become Amaro, bitters, drinking bitters. So it's just really cool to find out as much as you possibly can and, like, share that knowledge with other people. And Amaro specifically is really difficult to share knowledge of because the families, it's Italy, they're very secretive. They don't tell you what's in their stuff, right? It's their juice. So when you can find out some little tidbit about that particular product, it's really cool to share with other people because they have no idea that this whole tradition of drinking happens within the subculture of a subculture in Italy. You know, for Italy, we think of wines, and there's so much more than that. Grappa, Amaro, all kinds of cool stuff. Same thing goes for, you know, all the different whiskeys, like people trying to find out what makes a rye, what makes a bourbon, what scotch, which whiskey with an E versus no E. You know, there's just...
I've always wondered about the E thing and always forget to do my research.
So your E really depends on, if there's an E in the country that it comes from, then there's an E in your whiskey. So American whiskey has an E, scotch whiskey, no E.
Interesting.
Yeah. So you can go with that kind of, like, general rule of thumb, I guess.
When you were transitioning from your 9-to-5 to full-time bartending, did that feel like a risk? Like, I imagine that there's a lot less stability in bartending than there is with a job at Hopkins.
Very much so. Yeah, I left a nice, cushy, well-done salary to try to hack it. So there's no stability. It really requires a lot of financial planning on your behalf if you're going to be a bartender, because you need to set aside knowing exactly what your budget is, what you have to pay in terms of your rent or mortgage, and how are you going to get to that spot. If you are not making enough in tips that week, how are you going to supplement your income to make sure that it works? So yeah, lots of risk, but it was the best risk I possibly could have taken. I'd never taken any risks like that beforehand too. I'd been very content to kind of be unhappy in a 9-to-5 and not do anything about it, and I've always been a very financially minded human being because I grew up in a very much working class family that we didn't have big, we weren't affluent. Like, there was nothing in excess in our family. So I know exactly what I need to make to get by, and I never wanted to do anything that would have put myself in a position where I couldn't succeed at that. So yeah, huge, huge risk, but it paid off for me very well just by staying focused and continuing to educate myself, trying to develop my knowledge, myself as a brand, my ability to bartend, my ability to show people that I knew what I was doing and get, you know, additional offers and jobs and side things. And so, yeah, big risk.
In the beginning, did it ever seem like it wasn't going to be feasible? And did you have a side hustle or anything?
I was very fortunate to go to a place such as Wit and Wisdom, which was in the Four Seasons. It ended up not being my cup of tea personally. I was only there for 3 months because it was such high volume and such low staffing that it just wasn't feasible for mental, physical health to be in that situation. But it, because of high volume, it was a lot of money. So, you know, I was happy to walk away from that money just to try something else. So when I took over the Agio program, that was definitely more the risk because it was, there's a bar in this, you know, top chef restaurant where the food and the wine were what they're known for. Do they have a bar program? Not really. But we need it, so would you mind coming on and trying it out? I'm like, sure. So, you know, left the money to try that, and just, it was a blessing in disguise that they didn't pay any attention to the bar, because I kind of just ran away with it and developed this really cool Amaro program and weird cocktails and stuff that made it just as an addition a really cool thing to be at that restaurant for. And then slowly I started getting recognition for what I was doing, even though I was not the primary focus in that particular establishment.
Yeah, do you feel like that's kind of where you made your name for yourself? I think that's where at least a lot of people seem to have, like, that's when you got on Baltimore people's radar.
Yeah, for sure, Adagio. And, you know, the media was incredibly kind to me for when I was at Adagio, so I'm very thankful for that. I don't know who said what to make me do that or what I did exactly. I just know that I was working my tush off, and eventually it started to pay off. But, yeah, like, even in the Bartenders Guild, which I've been a part of for about 2 years, nobody knew me when I worked at my other bar for 5 years. Like, you were there? Like, yeah, for 5 years. And, you know, I've always been there, just kind of like hiding out, and nobody really knew who I was. So I've been on the bar scene here for a long time, and just nobody, I just kind of flew under the radar, which I guess is good, because I sure as hell was not making good cocktails when I was piecemealing things together and feeling it out and free pouring and shaking Manhattans and stuff like that at the first space. So yeah, Adagio was really my launching pad. I was very fortunate to get to work with an amazing sommelier, Chris Coker, and an amazing chef, Zach Long, who were my kind of feelers for everything I did. Like, Zach taught me how to make my syrups and use the kitchen equipment to be more culinary, make more culinary cocktails, make my own product before I tried to buy it. So if I wanted a particular syrup, we were going to try to make it first before I bought it, and I fell in love with that process too. He taught me about trying to make kombucha and vinegars and things like that, like started the process of it, and then I kind of spiraled out of control, took it to a whole nother level and fell in love with that stuff. So between the chef, the sommelier, and then my general manager, Eric, who actually brought me in the first place, he was the one that said, he had talked to my boyfriend, who said, I don't think, you know, this particular bar is the right fit for her. He's the one who said, do you want to give it a shot? And I said, okay. So the three of them, like, were my testing team, because it was basically a party of one there. I was the only bartender. Not until the very end did I hire a bunch bartender, and not until 6 months in did I hire a bar back, so I ran the whole thing. But they really helped me out. They were my tight little family that tested all my drinks, gave me feedback, and told me to try harder, do better, and it was amazing. It was a tiny, beautiful little family.
How much does the personal branding element come into it?
I had never thought about personal branding until the last year. Last year's been very difficult for me personally, but also amazing at the same time. It's like a really, really interesting balance. And my personal branding came very much into play when I immediately left Adagio, because the business, it's such a tough location. It's such an amazing concept that's in Power Plant. A fine dining Italian restaurant in Power Plant. It was so tough. And it was really tough to get people to come there, because there's a asbestos-ridden community college that's right in front of it that's shut down and boarded and, you know, blocks you from the rest of the world. So it was really, a really just tough space to work with. But where I went back to my original bar for a very brief period of time after I left there, and had to leave because the owner did something silly that got put on social media. And, you know, I had brands calling me saying, you know, we love you, but we'll never be able to support you at this particular bar. And that's where my personal brand came into play.
Which bar was that?
Bad Decisions.
Yeah, that's what I thought, yeah.
Yeah. So that's where I was for 5 years. I went back. I was going to hopefully take over the new space as a bar manager and do the events planning, and it sounded like it was going to be the biggest challenge of my life, because it was going to be working with my friends again but trying to get them back into really being excited about bartending, and then trying to get a new clientele coming in here and trying to make this like 10,000 square feet place somehow like be vibrant and active and lively and fill it with guests and stuff like that. But when that incident occurred in August and it blew up in my face, even though I didn't do anything, it was kind of like collateral damage, I walked away, because I didn't want my personal brand to be, you know, kind of tarnished. So I spent a little bit of time being unemployed at the end of 2016, and kind of went from there. Yeah. I haven't really talked about that publicly before. It was a very, very difficult time. It you know, I found out who really supported you and who kind of only half-ass supported you. It was a tough time, but I knew, like, in the end, I made the right decision because I couldn't be associated, like, as a, it, you know, had to deal with, like, an inappropriate comment to a woman, and as a very strong woman, as a the leader of female travel for roller derby, to a head coach for roller derby, to, you know, I'm a strong woman, I do all these things, like, I can't associate myself with that shit. And it really pissed me off that that opportunity was taken away from me because of something I didn't do. But I knew at the end of the day it was the right decision to walk away.
So how did the Our House job come up?
In October, I had been reaching out to the people from Our House to see if they needed help. I had been hearing about this going on for a long time. Like, it had been in development for a while. And eventually I just sent another email in September or October, and they're like, yeah, come in. We'd love to talk to you. And that kind of magically came around at that point in time. So I was moonlighting at Sugarvale for a little bit, and the Our House job came up. And then, you know, it's been 6 months that we've been working on it already. We've been open for almost 4, and I've been on the job for 6 months trying to develop everything.
And it's been packed constantly, right?
Oh, my God, it's insane. It is, again, high volume, definitely not something I thought I'd see myself in, because I just love talking to people so much. Obviously, you can tell by my voice, I love talking too much. it's insanely packed at all times. I'm absolutely blown away. Whether people are there for food or drinks or just to hang out and get some work done, it is packed. It is, I've been in the trenches on a Friday night or a Saturday night trying to be out and find a seat in the food hall, and it's absolutely impossible. And I quietly will duck back away into the office or behind the bar because I would never want to be in the middle of that. People love it. It's awesome. It is incredible how big and how busy that place is.
How has the Baltimore bar scene changed since you started working here? And what would you say is the appetite right now in Baltimore for craft cocktails?
I mean, we're growing exponentially. I feel like when I was at Bad Decisions back in like 2009 when I had started, or 2008, we were the craft cocktail bar. We were it. And then slowly these other things started popping up. Like, you had the original Rye, which was amazing. You have Bookmakers down in Fed Hill. You have the program at B&O Brasserie. There's just so many good craft cocktail bars. And now you've got more specialized spirits, such as like Clavel, Lane Harlan, Goddess.
And past podcast guests. Oh, gotta,
yeah,
plug
awesome.
That.
Yeah. Lane's amazing. I want to be Lane when I grow up, even though she's younger than me. She's really kind of brought Mezcal out of the world. It's always been there and never appreciated. And she has created the most hospitable environment with the best selection and the most educated bartenders to bring that to people. So I see a lot of these more specialized things coming up where people really get to do their niche work. And, you know, the trend towards gearing us back towards hospitality is really there, because there's a bunch of bars. There's always been bars. And Baltimore's always been a beer town and will forever be a beer town. But now we can kind of coexist in the cocktail world with them. But, like, people are really going out of their way, I think, now to focus back on hospitality. Which somewhere along the way, there was some hiccup, I guess, I feel. But I really see people trying to give the best experience to their guests again. And that's kind of a beautiful thing of itself. So I see Baltimore continuing to grow, getting weird, keeping Baltimore weird, and, like, doing more of the little, you know, specialized spirits. You know, we've got amazing whiskey bars. You've got, I mean, three right off the top of my head. You've got, God, there's way more than that. You've got Blue Pit. Down in Hamden, Union area, that's an American whiskey bar. You've got Barflies over on, I don't know if it's Locust Point or Fed Hill, technically, but out there, they've got an amazing selection of whiskey. Bookmakers has an extensive selection of whiskey. And you've got Bartenders down in Canton, crazy whiskey. Like, there's all these people that have whiskey bars, and now you've got Mezcal bars. Blue Agave was one of the original tequila bars, and I think they're kind of trying to refocus, and there's so much cool stuff that's happening in Baltimore.
Is it competitive?
To a degree, yes, but I feel that Baltimore, I can't tell you that for sure because I've never been a business owner, so I don't know the competition level. I know that within the Bartender Guild and the bartenders of the city of Baltimore, I feel like it's an incredibly supportive community. I feel like we are each other's best assets. I mean, we try to support one another by going to their events as much as humanly possible, as long as it's not, you know, on the same day as your own event. I see a really deep, heartfelt community that is in Baltimore with the bartenders and the hospitality group, and they try to lend a hand, be there supporting one another as much as humanly possible. I think it's kind of beautiful.
On the hospitality note, what qualities to you are the most important for a great bartender, and what makes a not great bartender?
I think not great bartenders are dismissive of the guests. Guests want what they want, and as long as they're not, you know, being abusive with their language with you, give them what they want. Like, if somebody wants a vodka soda, I'm going to make them the best damn vodka soda that they want. Vodka pays the bills. We'll just say it, you know, forever and ever and ever. Like, a good bartender understands that. Like, if they want a Bud Light and you have it, give it to them. If they want a vodka soda, give it to them. If they want the weirdest seven-ingredient drink that you could possibly think of, give it to them. As long as it's within reason, give the people what they want. Like, they're here to escape from something else, whether just to relax or get the hell out of work mode or get out of their house for a moment. People are coming to us as an escape. You should never treat that as like a burden. And I think that's the biggest frustration I have, is when bartenders feel burdened by their guests. You know, that's what drives me insane. But I think a good bartender is, you know, how do you say hospitable a million times and in a different, you know, different degree? Like, they're welcoming. They welcome you into their house. They see what they can get you. They ask how you're doing today. Like, I ask every person how they're doing before I ask them their drink order. I'm like, hey, how you doing today? Vodka soda. I was like, okay, but how are you doing? And they'll stop themselves for a second. Even the guests will be like, I'm great. Thank you. That's like it's the weirdest question they've ever been asked, but an epiphany just happened. Like, well, shit, I'm actually doing okay. Thank you for asking. Now may I have my vodka soda? Yes, absolutely. That's what I'm here for. You know, just being cordial and welcoming, like, treat it like it's your house and have them in there. You know, I say that to a degree, but when, like, if a guest is ever abusive or with their language or being rude or anything like that, then, you know, you don't have to bend over backwards for someone that's treating you or your staff inappropriately. But I think it sets the tone when we welcome them into our house to begin with, and kind of just set the tone for how it's going to be a good, enjoyable evening or experience at that time.
Does the bartender as therapist stereotype ring true for you?
Yeah. You got the therapist, you got the inane, just kind of silly conversations that always happen and repeat themselves, and you've got the dirty secrets that you keep, and yeah, that part never goes away. I think we are the trusted gatekeepers of the booze and the secrets. So,
do you like that part of it?
Yeah, to a degree. I think it's great, but I also, one of the biggest things I've been trying to preach within the community as of late is to practice self-care, because within our industry, there's a lot of secondary trauma that bartenders experience because of what they hear, because of what they see. Depending on what kind of bar you are or what area you're in, whether it's like a really high traffic place like Fells Point or Fed Hill, you could see people falling over and cracking their head on the sidewalk and you have to call them, you know, an ambulance. Like, there's traumatic things that you experience. Or you are holding the secret of, you know, two of your regulars are having an affair with one another and neither of their spouses know, but they like you so much and trust you so much that they're going to tell you everything and you need to keep that to yourself. Or, you know, some guest says something inappropriate to you and you're trying to process that without outwardly showing it to them and do your job well. And you have to pack all these things down until your 10 to 12 hour shift is over. And just being on. Like, you hear bartenders say that they're on. That means that they're smiling, lively, direct, no matter what the hell's happening on the back end of their world. They are there with the biggest smile and happy as they possibly can be to make the experience good for you while you're there. You do that for 10 hours every single day, and it wears down on you. So, yes, I love that part of the business, but it's also so critical at the same time that we make sure that we're practicing self-care to get the bad feelings out. Self-care being talking to somebody else, doing physical activity, drawing, coloring, things that made you happy when you were 5 years old. That's what you got to channel it back to. So as long as people are kind of melding that into their general daily repertoire, then it could be okay to be the therapist and be the bartender on a regular basis, you know.
Is the Baltimore bar scene at all like a boys' club, or have you had any negative experiences just having to be a female bartender?
Not within my community. I think, again, I think it's the biggest family that I've ever, you know, next to roller derby, where you have 80 immediate friends that are with you every single day. The bartending community is just as supportive. I feel nothing but love from our people. Like, guys, girls, anything in between. There's been experiences with guests where they won't, they ask a question about whiskey and they'll ask it to my male barback rather than me because they think, I don't know what they think. I don't know if they have a general, I don't know if he looks cuter than I do. I don't know if like they have a better association. I don't know what drives the person to ask that, but like I assure you I know a crap ton about whiskey. Let me yammer your ear off. I would love to. So there's little things like that. They're second guessing from my suggestions. And I take that very personally and probably to a fault, but I never let them show. Or, well, sometimes I say smart remarks. I catch myself doing it, but I do it with a big smile, but it's still, I'm saying smart remarks and I shouldn't.
Well, yeah, but you can't let people walk all over you. I'm sure that's a hard balance to strike.
Yeah, it definitely is. I've never been one to let anybody walk all over me. I refuse to let it happen. Instilled in me from a very early age, both my grandmothers are baller chicks. Like they are amazing, strong-ass, badass women. That really, I think, helped instill that. Plus, coming from a large Italian family, I think that helps instill that, too. You always are very vocal, use a lot of hand gestures, and you make your point very clear. Like, you will earn and demand respect. So there's little things from guests, but never within my own community. I feel like my community is one of my greatest assets.
Our house has been kind of polarizing in Remington. What has your experience of that been like, and what side do you fall on?
So everybody has a lot of feelings about our house. I hands down am the number one fan. I'm sure there are bigger fans, maybe. I don't know. I could be the number one. I live in Remington. I bought my house there 2 years ago. I couldn't be happier about our house coming into play. Even if I didn't work there, I'd still be happy about it. I live on a very busy section of Remington. I live on Huntington Avenue. I don't need to tell you where. It's like a very long, expansive road. I have drug dealers next to me. I have junkies next to me. I have people that scrap metal and steal things from doorsteps next to me. I have horrible racists that have been in the community forever next to me. I have really interesting things about me. There's also very beautiful things around me, but just pinpointing, like there's some shitty things in Remington. All that our house is doing is drawing attention to the area and letting people realize that it actually is a good place to live. And it's highlighting some of the slumlords, and it's highlighting that there are these issues that still exist in Remington and that need to kind of be pinpointed, adjusted, fixed, what have you. I think it's drawing a lot of attention to it, and I think that's a good thing. There is certainly gentrification that's happening, but I think it's for the better because it's, especially with like bringing to light the slumlords that are allowing bad things to continue happening on these houses, and the people that are renting them are allowed to like, you know, I get a mouse or a roach because my neighbors are doing, are pack rats and aren't cleaning or doing anything like that. You know, whatever. Those are all really minor things, but I think Remington is really benefiting from our house. I know there's a lot of flack about it. I know people think that prices might be too high or that it's detracting from other things in the area, but I think it's doing the complete opposite. People have come to our house. They might not like it. They realize that they love the Diz, Long John's, Paper Moon, Parts and Labor, what have you, around the neighborhood, and I think that's great. Like, if it's not for you, that's great. Now you remember that you have all these other awesome things in your neighborhood that you weren't frequenting before. I think it is a really good fill of the space that would have just been an abandoned auto shop. You know, like it didn't take anybody out. It didn't push anybody out. It didn't kick anybody out. It didn't replace something that was already there. It filled a void. And I think that's really beneficial. I still love Long John's. I still love, you know, Paper Moon. I love these things. And I think they each serve their own purpose for the community. When I get done on my shift, I want to go to Long John's and I want to have a special, you know, a beer and a shot. And I think that's a magical thing. It just added something else to the puzzle that is Remington and really highlighted some things that need to be addressed. And I think that the group that has put our house into place is doing a phenomenal job. And I'm happy that I had the opportunity to be there. I would be there even if I wasn't working there. So I'm pro our house. Obviously.
What's missing from the Baltimore bar scene right now that you would like to see?
I think cart service, like having somebody roll a cart out to like make a drink in front of you.
Oh, that's cool. I've never heard of that.
Oh, it's so cool. I feel like there's someone in our community that is has that in their mindset and might be trying to do that. And I think that's an amazing thing, and I hope they do it really soon. But that will definitely be a really cool thing added to it. I think more focus on like sustainable practices in the bar scene, like some bar that's completely focused on that. You have it already with like Woodbury, but I think they don't get nearly enough attention for what they are trying to do. I think it's a positive thing. I think some people think it's a little cultish, and I think it serves a very positive role in the environment. Like the thing is we all can exist in here. We're all just making up the framework of the city. Like there's no reason why we can't have the dive bars, the beer bars, the cocktail bars, the whiskey bars, the mezcal bars, the Morrow bars. Like all of these exist and like make this really cool, you know, weave this wonderful tapestry that is the Baltimore cocktail scene. So I'd love to see more spirit-focused places. So like, let there be a Soju bar, let there be a Sake bar, let there be another Amaro bar. Yeah, I want that. Yeah, I'd like to see just more niche stuff so we can really get weird and focus on the cool stuff.
Do you have like a dream bartending job?
I would love to have my own bar someday. Something tiny, something, you know, maybe a little bit bigger than the size of this room right now. But like, I want a tiny little bar. I want to call it the Junkyard Doll. And I want to have bitters all over the place and do weird stuff and just be able to educate people. Just have like a little family room bar kind of thing. I know nothing about owning a bar, so that's going to be very difficult. But in a dreamland, that would be really cool.
Amy, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Amy Ward. If you liked this episode of Female Trouble, you might enjoy past interviews with bar and restaurant owner Lane Harlan, Charm City Roller Girls co-founder Amy Kallner, and bartender Chelsea Gregoire. You can find all of those and more on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on Twitter at FMLTrouble and online at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring Baltimore's own TT the Artist. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.